very much. Y'all can be seated. All right, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to have you here today. Justices Kelly, Triana, and I would like to welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. We've only got one case for oral argument this morning, and that case is 0321294 CV, Texas Telephone Association and a bunch of other folks, versus the PUC of Texas et al. This matter is being recorded and as well as shown live via our YouTube channel. During the pandemic, we've made our hearings available via YouTube, although there are also individuals, for those of you who are watching via YouTube, here in the courtroom as well. The folks here in the courtroom are socially distanced and wearing masks, as is required by our local rule related to the pandemic. But the audio, and for the first time, the Third Court of Appeals is now making our videos remaining live on our YouTube channel. So our audio will be available on our website this afternoon, and going forward, our videos will also be available. So make sure your hair is coiffed and all of those things, because you know it's for all of history. For those new to the Third Court of Appeals, each side is allocated 20 minutes to argue. Mr. Kyle's already worked, our staff has already worked to coordinate that time with our counsels. I understand the appellates are going to start their argument with 7 minutes and then split to five with one of their co-counsels. There are three counsels here on behalf of the appellants. The appellees will then have their full 20 minutes, and then the appellants have requested 8 minutes in rebuttal. We do have a lighting system here in the courtroom to assist the attorneys in staying on time. That lighting system will show a yellow light warning the attorneys when they only have 2 minutes left of their allotted time. And then when the light goes red, you'll need to wrap up. Certainly the court can grant, with its discretion, additional time if you're in the midst of an argument that they would like more meat on the bone discussion. At this point, I'd like to call this case for ready announcements from the attorneys this morning. And so I'll ask that the attorneys for the appellants to introduce yourself for the record, please, gentlemen.
I'm Craig Enick, representing some of the appellants in the case.
Michael Heidler, representing some of the appellants in the case.
And Daniel Gibson, representing some of the appellants in the case.
Thank you. And now for the appellees. Yes, sir.
Cody Rutowski, representing the appellees in the case.
All right. Thank you so much. And counselors, we will have Mr. Knowles here, is going to try to keep us all safe and well so that everybody gets out of here without catching anything at the Third Court of Appeals. So we have cleaned the podium, but in between each argument, if you will just pause a moment, give us an opportunity to clean the podium before you take over the podium, that would be greatly appreciated. And with that, we'll start with counsel for the appellants. It's going to be speaking for 7 minutes.
May it please the court, I have a great appreciation for the name of the bunch of the parties in this case. It took my whole first page of my notes to write down the names of them, so I'll just skip to my second page. We did want to thank the court for expediting this appeal. I hope you will understand from our briefing and from our argument the urgency that my clients have in getting a resolution through this court. Over two decades ago, the legislature adopted a policy that was for the economic well-being of the state and for the well-being of the state's citizens, that everyone have reasonable access to telephone service. They expressly identified service to the disabled, service to rural areas of the state, and service to the poor, historically considered high-cost services. They also expressly instructed that those services would be provided at comparable rates, rates comparable to what our person and I described living in Austin would be paying for their telephone services. And over.
Curiously, yes, I want to ask you one thing on that, Justice Enick, and that is, services? Are we talking landlines? Are we talking wireless? Are we talking, what are we talking?
We're talking landlines, essentially. We're talking about the infrastructure.
Yes, sir.
For getting the telephone services to where they go. It's not like electricity. There's a common fee that people pay to transport that electricity so that it ensures the people across the state have access to electricity at reasonable rates. This telephone infrastructure was designed. Additionally, those decades ago, the PUC, as it was instructed by the legislature, adopted a series of rules to assess commonly a fund that would then be used to support those providers who are providing these high-cost disabled services and services to the poor. Now, how this works is the PUC will go to a provider, and this provider is eligible providing those kinds of services to determine what it would cost for the provider to provide those services to Mrs. Smith and the Davis Mountains. And the provider comes back and says, and this is just like any other rate case. Some can set rates that can be challenged. Others can initiate a rate case. And it'll be just like any other rate case. The PUC stands guard to make sure that reasonable charges and costs are being calculated and that a reasonable return on investment is permitted. And then a determination, well, that reasonable rate, this provider, that reasonable rate is actually higher than a comparable rate in downtown Austin. So we will assess, we will contribute to that provider X dollars. It'd be like saying the comparable rate's $3 to the phone owner, but for this Fort Davis, it's going to be $5. So we're going to, out of the fund, contribute $2 to the provider so that the charge will be $3 to the consumer. That's been going on for decades.
So let me interrupt you. With the advent of wireless, you know, there's less and less people that are having landlines. I understand the argument and the legislature wanting, you know, rural Texas and disabled folks to have the service. But can't you argue that it's not as necessary now since those people have access to wireless phones at comparable rates as the people that live in Austin?
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, but the agency does not have the authority to do that. As we've explained in our brief, the agency must comply with state legislative directives, and it must comply with its own rules unless it goes through a rulemaking proceeding to change their rules. So we are here with a picture that's set. It's already drawn. The issues you raise, however, was presented at the legislature in the last legislative session. The legislature looked at it. Maybe we ought to have voiceover IP somehow included in the mix of where we have the assessments going. Maybe we have a further definition of high cost, but then the governor vetoed that. We have a set picture, and the question is.
And as to the veto, I mean, is that any, obviously it doesn't necessarily mean that we should consider that in this case, but can you give us any light as to what that's all about and what, if any, you know, importance we should give to that, to the fact that the legislature tried to fix this in a certain way and the governor vetoed that bill?
Your Honor, the only way you can take from that is it would become a red herring for the court to consider what could have, should have, or might have happened. As I say, the court has before it a set picture. It has a statute that says what the agency is to do, and you have set rules that the agency itself imposed on itself, and it actually intentionally refused either to obey the law or its own rules. If the court has any question about jurisdiction, we have an exhibit that's a chart that demonstrates the causes of action, and obviously you have jurisdiction to do so. But I would say more to that, beyond that, this court not only has a duty to exercise jurisdiction, which it does, but it has the duty to act. It has a duty to move forward. This court, it is particularly a purview of a court. When an agency refuses to obey its directive from the legislature and refuses to use its rules without a appropriate rulemaking authority, it is the purview of this court to step in and say, PUC, do your job. Now, we've cited the legislative provisions that set up the policy and the directions, We've cited the rules that said, PUC, this is what you're going to do. As I said, they've already said, already have orders, valid orders, in your exhibit, the appendix four to the brief always tells you there is nothing more to do than for the PUC to follow its rules, assess appropriate fund, and distribute it immediately. We asked the court to set aside the amendment to the contract, which is the ad hoc, which is the rule that was adopted ad hoc, and we asked the court to direct the PUC to do its job under its rules. And finally, this is a Uniform Declaratory Judgment Act to order them to do what they're supposed to do, and we are entitled to our attorney's fees. So we ask for a remand on that point for us to collect our attorney's fees.
I'm going to interrupt you again, and know that you're on yellow, but I've got a couple of questions. So explain to me, and I really appreciate the table, tab A, which tells us, I think it's A, this is what we're asking. I can't tell you how much, you know, sometimes we get through the whole briefs, I'm like, I'm not really sure what it is you want us to do. So you are wanting us to reverse and render. If we find that the trial court was wrong and that it does have jurisdiction, why would that not be a reverse and a remand, specifically to the TOMA claims, to the taking claims? You know, I understand that your clients had a motion for summary judgment, but I did not see anything in the record that showed that the trial court ruled on it. I know that the trial court ruled on the, appellee's plea to the jurisdiction and alternatively a motion for summary judgment. But explain to me how you think that this court would have, if we do find and agree with you that there, that we have jurisdiction, how can we go to that next step and just render versus remanding to the trial court?
I appreciate the question, Your Honor. By the way, that trial judge had this same issue come up in a second case and decided, whoa, wait a minute, I think I'm wrong in the first case. As to your question about it, as a question, she just changed her mind, obviously, because her order is different. I'm sure it was all reflection on the arguments, and really, having had the opportunity to look at it, came with a different conclusion. But that wouldn't be kind of, that's just an aside. On answer to your question, the court, this is a direct appeal of the court's ultra vires action. This is a direct appeal of the rules creating, of the PUC creating rule ad hoc. Those are legal determinations. You've asked about the threshold of the summary judgment that the court has. The issue here is the facts have not changed. This court would have a duty to render because there are no fact issues. You don't necessarily have to have, well, we brought a summary judgment, then therefore you do. This disposes of it. If the court determines they acted ultra vires in the amendment of that contract, in the refusal to obey the law, this court can render that was an ultra vires act and vacate the amendment to the contract. This court, having seen the ultra vires act, and having seen the attempt at a rule ad hoc, can order the PUC to follow its rules. There, it is there. The remand questions come, one, we're entitled to get our attorney's fees in this case. But in other words, if it is a Seventh Amendment taking, then yes, there would be further proceedings to determine what the takings would be. If it is a TOMA, well, yes, it still would vacate the PUC order and then just order the PUC to have a hearing again. These are the alternatives we've raised, but the two important cases
are
ad hoc.
And so those are your alternative pleadings, TOMA and the takings.
That's correct.
And what you're really focused on is the ultra vires and the ad hoc rule.
And we should win on that.
And I'm so sorry, but I have one more question. Under your UDJA claim, why is that not the same claim as you're asking for an injunction as your ultra vires claims? Why is that not a redundant claim?
Oh, yes. Two things. One is an ultra vires act gets vacated, but we have two things. Remember, what we have is we have trial court, or we have PUC orders on what the rate of the rural provider would be, and an order specifically identifying to the penny the money that will be paid to them promptly to make their rate to their customer comparable. That's There was an amendment to that ordering the vendor, the contractor, not to pay that. That should be vacated. Now, the UDJA has to do, well, what do we do now? Well, they ought to pay it. But there's another section here. And the section is the PUC refused to accept the staff report calculating how much the PUC had committed to pay for the purposes of making this system-wide assessment to have sufficient funds to pay all the bills. So there was a refusal to do that. That's not a simply a vacate the refusal. That calls for an injunction to the PUC to follow its orders. So that's why we think the UDJA is not simply a mirror image of our request to vacate. There's two parts to it.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And if you'll give us a moment to clean the podium, we'll hear from the appellant's second counsel.
Yes, sir. Yield the rest of my time to Mr. Gibson.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you, Mr. Knowles.
But how could you, why would you trust me when I said I love you if you know I've always been a liar, Mr. Knowles?
We are too, just so you know. All right, let's hear from our next counsel for the appellants. And counsel, before you get started, I've got on the ultraviolets, I do want you to address the issue. Isn't your argument that the Ultraviolets Act is the failure to pay the ordered amounts, not how the PUC chooses to do that? I mean, yeah, they can assess if they want. Don't they have discretion to decide whether to raise the assessment rate or not? And if they choose not to raise the assessment rate, doesn't the PUC have other pockets of money they could draw from? But the Ultraviolets Act is you issued orders that said this amount was due, and your failure to pay is the Ultraviolets Act. How you do that, PUC, is your own personal problem.
May it please the court, I'm Daniel Gibson. And to start with what you asked about right there, the Ultraviolets Act of the commission, you're absolutely correct. We're not contesting the fact that they have to raise the assessment rate. What we're talking about here is that the PUC is required by statute to fund the TUSF. What the statute says is that it's funded by uniform charge. If you look at their rules say we're going to determine how much it takes to pay the cost of the program, and then PUC, you come up with the funds to do that. They have used their own rule to create this assessment on revenues. Statute doesn't put an assessment on revenues. The PUC has put the assessment on revenues. We believe they have a lot of discretion and a lot of tools at their disposal as to how to fund. They do not have any discretion to just not fund it. They put all of these orders in place. The statute very clearly
Let's put a fine point on that.
Sure.
Not to fund it. Isn't it where they have no discretion is failing to pay you? I don't care whether it comes from this fund or your general fund or wherever PUC you got pockets of money, your job is to pay us, period. It'd be nice if it comes from the fund because that's the mechanism by which you do it, but you have no discretion to pay. How you figure it out, PUC, again, is within your discretion. I mean, isn't that the difference?
I believe it's really both.
Okay.
Because in law, it sets out, especially as to the rate of return carriers, it sets out how their support is to be determined, how their support is to be adjusted. And so when those orders come out, that the PUC has then followed those rules and it says you will pay them this much, they don't have any discretion after that. When that order's in place and that order was put into place through the correct processes, through the statutory processes that were put in place, they're now obligated to pay it. It's up to them to decide how to come up with the money, but the legislature has given them tools to do that. They have not said it has to be through an assessment on revenues. They can have a rulemaking to determine how are we going to collect these funds. As long as it's a uniform, non-discriminatory.
Could be it if they want it, you know. They
yes.
just start flipping up social. Okay.
Yeah, a rulemaking, you know, a discussion that's properly noticed and had, you know, the industry would be more than happy to sit before the PUC and talk through options of how they could come up with it. But again, the discretion to not pay it is not there. Very quickly, I'm going to talk about two of the other items that haven't been brought up yet. One is the takings claim that we talk about here. Very clearly, the state agrees with us as to the factors that we look at as far as the economic impact. You've got $120 million so far.
And is Windstream one of your clients?
Windstream is not one of my clients. Okay. But I'm familiar with them as well. I represent a lot of the small and rural telephone co-ops and independent family-owned, so I represent the smallest of the small.
I was going to ask, and I don't know if you want to answer this while you're also talking about your clients. I was a little confused as to the confiscatory takings argument, and how is that different than the regular regulatory takings argument?
Well, the regulatory takings argument, and Mr. Heidler, who does represent those companies, may want to address this a little more in rebuttal when he comes up in a minute.
Okay, if he's doing rebuttal, we can wait for that.
Sure. But, you know, very, very clearly they have a little bit different situation, and they're talking some there about having to operate at a loss because they're not rate of return companies similar to we are. They do have those same provider of last resort obligations and having you know, to sometimes operate at a loss because they don't have that same rate of return regulation that the rest of my clients fall underneath. But very quickly, the only thing they really oppose here as to the factors is saying that we can't base that claim on inaction. When we look at what the PUC has done here, it's not only action, but it's affirmative action that institutes the most substantive change to TUSF in the last 20 years. Putting it into place a completely new scheme which prioritizes the different programs within the fund and then choosing to prorate the payments based on just the availability of funds, those are two things that are not contained anywhere in statute. They're not contained anywhere in the rules. And the implementation of this through the discussion that was had at the June 2020 open meeting and the subsequent contract amendment, which the executive director put into place, these two things put into place, again, the most substantive change in TUSF. To say that this change that was implemented is inaction just can't be. You can't implement that huge of a change through inaction.
And I see that you've run out of time. Any questions?
I don't have any questions, but if it's okay, since I took some of his time asking him about somebody else, if he can.
Absolutely. You have a few more moments to
sure.
wrap up your thoughts.
And I'll keep it very brief. Just very briefly, we haven't talked much about the Open Meetings Act claim, but you're looking at a situation here where public interest was extremely high. And public interest dictates the amount of notice and the detail of notice that's needed when action is taken, when things are discussed. Here, you've got a docket that has over 50 filings in it that has schools, hospitals, ag groups, about two-thirds of the legislature weighing in. It would be hard to argue that there's not a lot of public interest here. And yet, this change was implemented. The discussion that was had on the 20th didn't follow with the notice that was there. The notice talked about raising the assessment rate. This has been done historically numerous times. The reasonable expectation was it was going to be done again.
Mr. Gibson,
yes, ma'am.
What about the PUC's argument that in 2019, they issued an order that delegated authority to the PUC's executive director to make an award, negotiate pricing and performance requirements, execute the contract, and administer the contract for TUSF. That, you know, we've delegated this authority to this commissioner, so we don't have to have he already independently has that authority, or she independently has that authority. What's your position on that? Can that be delegated?
Good question, Justice Kelly. So when we look at this, the commission cannot delegate powers they don't have themselves. When you look at that delegation, you named off a lot of things there, finding an administrator, signing the contract, general administration. None of those things are, and that was with a previous director. The day that this contract amendment was signed, it was a new executive director that was just appointed that morning during executive session. And so you've got a new executive director. He is now signing an amendment that substantively changes the contract. It implements new policy of a hierarchy, a prioritization of programs. So this was not simply a delegation of, yes, go find the administrator, negotiate the price with the administrator, sign the contract, and work with them to administer it. This is changing it in ways that actually violate statutes and rules. And the PUC cannot simply avoid open meetings, avoid their own duties by delegating something to the executive director.
Thank you, Council.
With that, I'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you. And if you'll bear with us just a moment. Mr. Rutowski, yes, sir.
May it please the court. As your honors have acknowledged, there have been fundamental shifts in the telecommunications marketplace, and those shifts have rendered the TUSF unsustainable as it is currently structured. In the absence of new legislation addressing this dilemma, the commission has exercised the considerable discretion and authority the legislature has given it to make the best out of a tough situation here. So specifically, I'm talking about sections 56.023D of the Utilities Code, where the legislature gives the commission the authority to act as necessary and convenient to administer the TUSF. And that's
so how does your commission square that with the Utility Code 51.001G that sets out the state policies that consumers in all regions of the state have access to telecommunications services that are available at prices that are reasonably comparable to prices charged for similar services in urban areas? The legislature spoke through that utility code. What evidence in the record shows that the commission's choices honor that balancing requirement? I mean, the commission chose not to assess like it has been doing forever. The governor chose to veto this last session what the legislature put in front of him, and he had three other special sessions and did nothing. So how does all that square to allow the commission to ignore the utility code in assuring that these citizens of this state have access to comparable telecommunications services at reasonably comparable prices?
Yes, Your Honor, a few responses to that. And I believe Section 51 also, 0.001 also says that it is the policy of the state for rates to be just, fair, and comparable, or just, fair, and reasonable. Included in that would be the assessment rate, or the uniform charge that is applied to fund the TUSF.
And isn't the record showing that that would raise all of us 75 cents a month, whereas one of these telecommunication providers said that without you guys funding, Mr. Smith out in the hinterlands in Texas, his bill is going to increase by 100%. So that citizen of Texas gets to pay 100% more for his, whereas if you assessed, all of us would be paying 75 whopping cents a month to make sure that people in the hinterlands in our state have access to reliable telecommunications.
Well, on the issue of whether it is just a 75-cent charge, I guess at this point it's unclear what the charge would need to be, because the assessment base continues to shrink due to line loss and fewer and fewer amounts of revenue being assessed or allocated to basic telecommunication services. So the problem we have with plaintiff's line of thinking here is that there's really no end to what the commission would have to do or how high the rate would have to go. Maybe it's only 75 cents now, but it could go on to infinity, and their position is that the commission has no power to do anything about that whatsoever, and that it could let that rate on every Texan go, or it would be forced to impose a rate that high on every Texan. And our position here is that its authority, its duty to ensure that rates are just, fair, and reasonable for every Texan gives it some authority not to do that.
And also the legislature chose not to do anything because the governor vetoed. So where do the citizens of Texas go to get comparable rates? If the legislature's bill got vetoed and the commission's choosing not to take any action, what does Mr. Smith do that has a landline that they can't afford and they can't call EMS or 911 or...
So these telecommunication companies do have the options of bringing rate cases and attempting to change their rates. And the question of whether those rates would still be comparable is something that is committed to the PUC's discretion and something that it can evaluate, and something that, frankly, at this point has not been put before them, because they have not sought to raise their rates at this point.
Where is your discretion not to pay when you have your own orders that say you are owed X? And that's what we have to pay you. We will pay you X, and you're not paying them X.
So two responses on that. First, the orders are not quite as explicit on this point as the plaintiffs make them out to be. They establish the eligibility amount, the amount that they can receive, and the actual ordering paragraphs set the amount. There is nothing ordering the PUC in those particular paragraphs to actually pay those amounts. And implicit in those, and this is my second point, implicit in those is that there will be sufficient funding in the TUSF to actually pay these. Now, these are TUSF support amounts, so to go back to your earlier question, that is the only source of funding here, is the TUSF itself. And under Section 56.022, the only source of funding for the TUSF is the uniform charge on telecommunications services here. And again, the commission has broad discretion in setting that charge, and because it is on services and at rates that the commission determines under section, I believe it's section C of that, section 56.022. The only limitations on that discretion are that you can't apply it to payphone services, and you can't apply it in such a way as to create an unreasonable prejudice or preference or grant an unreasonable advantage or disadvantage to any particular telecommunications provider. Now, there's also the command in section 53.003 and section 52.002A to ensure that rates are just, fair, and reasonable. And that applies to this uniform charge, too. So that's another boundary on the commission's discretion here. So the commission has exercised its discretion in that point in setting this rate.
Can I ask a couple of questions, Mr. Rutowski? First one is, if the commission was concerned that the fund was no longer solvent and that the rate was no longer reasonable, wouldn't the proper way to handle that was to do it through rulemaking proceeding under the APA, give everybody, you know, the right to comment on it? Wouldn't that be the correct way to do it as opposed to just a change overnight?
So I'll return again to section 56.023D, which gives the commission the authority to act as necessary and convenient here. And when this issue came up, I mean, this has been coming to a head for a while, but when the commission considered it in its June 2020 hearing, the option before it was whether to nearly double the assessment rate. At this point, it would have to be even more than double it to sustain it. And it exercised discretion that it already has under section 56.022 to not raise the assessment rate, and then utilized its authority to act as necessary and convenient to not pay out money that it doesn't have.
But what about section 56.026, which requires prompt and efficient disbursement so that the telecommunication providers does not experience an unnecessary cash flow change as a result of a change in government policy? I mean, it seems to me that the legislature is trying to prevent this exact thing from happening.
So I have two responses on section 56.026. The first is that that section is really addressed to the timing of payments made. The actual statutory command there is that the commission shall make the disbursements promptly and efficiently. And there's no disagreement here about when we've been making the payments. Their disagreement here has been about the amount. So it doesn't actually speak to this direct issue. Now, second point on that is, even assuming that it did speak to the amounts, there's an important qualifier in there, which is the word unnecessary. And at this point, the PUC has determined that whatever cash flow changes the plaintiffs here and telecommunications providers are experiencing here is an unfortunate necessity of the shifts in the telecommunications marketplace that have rendered the TUC or the TUSF unsustainable in its current form.
So, Mr. Rutowski, is it your position that the PUC has the authority to fund this this account at the TUSF at whatever, you know, however much or little they desire? They have total discretion to do that. Whether it's a penny, whether it's $10, they can make the assessment rate at any level, and it doesn't matter whether the fund is, you know, filled and overflowing, or, you know, there's just barely anything at the bottom.
So at this point, that is not the situation we face here. There is still, the fund is still fully paying out for the social welfare programs, Lifeline, and programs of that nature. And
but my question is, could they? Not what's happening now, but under your argument, you know, do they have total discretion to do that under their, you know, under their authority to either make it high or make it low and keep the fund at whatever level it may be, because they're the PUC?
So there may be some outer bound here, but I think the better, the true disciplining authority here, or the true limitation here, will be the political accountability of the commissioners through the governor himself. If the commission just decided to stop funding this entirely and citizens throughout the state lost Lifeline services and lost the other services and all of their customers lost services entirely, then that is something that the political accountability, we would entrust the political branches to keep the PUC from doing that.
Kind of like a Snowmageddon again.
Yeah, sure. Yes, sir.
In the telecommunications world.
Yes, sir.
Do you agree with Mr. Enoch's position that if the court determines that there's jurisdiction on and that this is an ultra-virus act by the commission, that that's the end of the hunt, that then we just remand for attorney's fees?
Well, that's, I guess, assuming that the takings claim has been denied or there's not been relief granted on that, there would need to be a remand for whatever damages would be due under the takings claim, or just compensation would be due. And I guess our position is that if it is a matter of just the legal issues to be resolved here, then I believe this court could render. There's at least on just the purely legal issues presented. This case was presented to the court on cross motions for summary judgment, along with our plea to the jurisdiction.
There's no fact issues if we come to that determination.
No fact issues other than the amount of any just compensation that may be due. We contend it's not, or any attorney's fees that may be due, which again, we contend or not.
And do you have any thinking about, you know, the other case that is on appeal in our court as well? From the same trial judge, which seems to have found differently in that case. They had denied the state's plea to the jurisdiction.
So, Your Honor, I will admit I am not fully up to speed on that case that was handled by other trial counsel, but as the filings in that case to this court have shown, we think these cases are the same, or at least impossible. Those two decisions from the trial court are impossible to reconcile.
Okay.
That is why we moved in the other case to stay the briefing in that, because we think whatever the court does here will ultimately resolve that appeal in the AMA case.
Okay.
Because we just don't really see the daylight between them at this point. All right, now if I may continue, I guess I will move on to address, I mentioned the regulatory or the takings claims here. First, I do want to say the confiscatory takings claim is not properly before this court. I mean, you even heard Mr. Gibson here refer to it as CenturyLink and Windstream's claim, not a claim that they brought below. If you look at their reply brief, CenturyLink and Windstream's reply brief, well, first look at TTA and TSTCI's reply brief, where they expressly declined to address the confiscatory takings claim, and I believe it's footnote 5 of their brief. CenturyLink, what they asked this court and Windstream, what they asked this court to do is go through and read between the lines of the summary judgment pleadings and the live petition here to try to find a claim, which the Texas Supreme Court has said that is not what the Court of Appeals is supposed to do here. There is something that was not fairly presented before the court, and as a result has been waived and cannot, it's not at issue here. So now to address the regulatory takings claim itself, we focused our briefing on the third prong there, which is the nature of the government action. There may be some issue on the second prong there, which is the impact on investment-backed expectations. As some of the commissioner's testimony, which is, I believe, on pages 1196 through about 1200 of the clerk's record, the commission has some concern here that the funds for the TUSF and these support amounts are not being used as they were originally intended. When this was passed, as I said, 2 decades ago, and when this was set forth, the idea was basic local telecommunication services. And this is pretty much just voice services. You pick up your phone, you get a dial tone. Doesn't include texting, doesn't include internet, doesn't include any sort of data. So those are things that the TUSF is not supposed to fund, and they're things that it really can't be funded by. We can't apply the assessment rate to raise revenues from those issues. Now, what has happened is, at the time, there was the idea that these would be just basic copper wires that would be landlines that would be used to install. And instead, what we've seen a lot of is more broadband wires. And those can certainly provide the basic telecommunication services, but they also provide internet. And that's probably their better utility, is actually that they are providing internet functionality. So the question of whether it was reasonable for them to basically use, I guess one analogy I've been playing with is, we've tried to give them money to support like a basic car that'll get them around. That's what they want. Instead, they went and borrowed an airplane. It can still, you know, move around on the ground, but at the same time, it can also fly. And that's not something that we were really, that the TUSF was intended to do. That's not what the legislature had in mind here. And that is an issue that broadband is something that was addressed in the most recent regular session. Whether it was reasonable for them to continue to expect the TUSF to be used to fund at the same rates when they've gone about it in ways, instead of just looking at basic telecommunication services, there is some question on that second prong there. But again, our focus here has been on the third prong, which is the nature of the government action here. And we say that what it really is inaction here. Because at the end of what the particular property issue here, and they say this, TA and TSDCI say this in page 53 of their opening brief, is that the actual property that is subject to the taking here has been the TUSF support payments. To the extent that those have been taken, that was really the result of not raising the assessment rate here, and that is an inaction here. If you look at the commission's, the committee, if you look at the open hearing, the transcript from the June 2020 hearing, the commission didn't take any action on that recommendation. They just left it there. So they just left the rate at what it had been. So there's no action there. Similarly, that's why there can be no APA challenge to that particular decision, whether to fully fund the TUSF, is because there's no actual action for them to challenge under the APA. Now, Texas law is clear that inaction itself cannot lead to a regulatory taking. And it's done so in much more dark and dire circumstances, specifically the Kerr case, I believe, where it's Harris County Flood Control, where it's talking about flooding, actually, and the Flood Control Board's inaction to stop flood damage. And there was a plan that they were considering there to complete and just never actually completed the plan. That inaction that led to that still could itself not be a taking. So here, the commission's inaction on its staff's report or its staff's proposal to raise the assessment fund is itself a similar inaction. That cannot be the subject of a taking here. And to turn back to that point here, the commission, I guess, still has discretion under its own rules to set the assessment rate. Now, there's nothing in the rules that actually dictates how the commission will set the assessment rate. I believe opposing counsel here was referring to section 26.420E of Title 16 of the Administrative Code, which talks about calculating the amount needed to fund the TUSF. And noticeably absent from that subsection is the word assessment rate or uniform charge or anything. What that subsection is instead about is giving the PUC the information it needs to exercise its discretion when setting the uniform charge. An important component of that is figuring out what your costs are. And at the end of it, the last part of that subsection says that the amount shall be approved by the commission. Again, that approval is talking about the calculation and ensuring that that calculation is correct, so that the PUC, when it exercises its discretion under section 56.022 of the Utilities Code, has the correct information and is making an informed decision, which is what the PUC did here. There's no argument here that the PUC did not know what the amounts necessary were. It exercised its discretion to keep the rates just fair and reasonable at what they were. To adjust the Open Meetings Act claim briefly, we're largely rest on our briefs on that, and that there was a valid delegation of authority to the executive director to execute that contract amendment, and was not something that needed to be done in an open meeting. Similarly, we don't think that contract amendment is a rule under the APA. It is instead a guideline. This court and other courts have made it clear that not every agency pronouncement is a rule under the APA, and that agencies often put out guidelines that may seem like they have some amount of policy to them, if I may finish the point briefly. But to call each one of those guidelines, which it is what the PUC refers to its contract provisions in section 26.420D2, I believe, of its regulations. It refers to the contract provision as guidelines. To require all of those to go through the formal rulemaking process would really make it impossible for agencies to fulfill their legislative mandate.
Can I ask you one question about the TOMA claim? I mean, obviously it's not a jurisdictional issue. There's waiver of sovereign immunity under the act. Was your summary judgment motion and no evidence, I mean, how, if we were to agree with you that it is not ultra vires and you know, we don't have a rule violation, how do we get to dismiss the case on the TOMA action?
Right, so it was a summary judgment motion on that particular claim, and the evidence in the record does support dismissing that claim because it shows there is the order in the record where the commission delegates the authority to negotiate the contract to the executive director, and there's no evidence in the record suggesting that there was any directive from the PUC in a closed session to execute that particular amendment.
Don't you grant a summary judgment, not dismiss a case, unless you're dealing with a no evidence summary judgment? Because the court order dismissed it, and there's jurisdiction, that equals dismissal. So how do you dismiss it when you have jurisdiction to rule on it and you don't have the court order saying, I grant your summary judgment motion?
So, Your Honor, if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that the order itself doesn't actually speak
grant
to either of the summary judgment. It doesn't.
Right.
We're saying it's implicit in there that it must have granted our summary judgment motion, and that perhaps just a typo or something should have said that it granted our summary judgment because it resolved the claims. There's no dispute that that is the end and that trial court's judgment was final. They're not saying this is an interlocutory appeal related to a denial of a plea to the jurisdiction or a grant of a plea to the jurisdiction. It should have granted, or that's what it should have said. We say that's implicit in the judgment itself.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Keith. And if you'll stand by, we'll get the podium cleaned and take our rebuttal.
Do you know why they are attempting to bring this in here?
Thank you so much.
May it please the court. Michael Heidler for the appellants Windstream and CenturyLink. Your Honor, you asked a great question to Mr. Ratowski. You asked, where do the citizens of Texas turn when the governor vetoes the legislature's bill and the PUC is not paying what's owed and it's not funding the TUSF? The answer is the courts. That's why we're here. When public officials refuse to follow their statutory mandates, the courts are empowered to step in and enforce Texas law. And that's what we're asking the court to do today. Justice Triano, you asked a question about regulatory takings and confiscatory takings. What's the difference between those? We filed and pursued a regulatory takings claim. Confiscatory takings is just a type of regulatory takings claim. And under the Supreme Court's decision in Lee versus Pemberton Park, which we cited in our briefs, a party preserves appellate issues for appeal. You don't preserve arguments for appeal. When we raise the issue of a regulatory taking, confiscatory taking is an argument to show why a regulatory taking has occurred, and that argument was preserved in the trial court under the Lee versus Pemberton Park decision. On the confiscatory takings issue, it's undisputed that all of these appellants are statutorily required to use their utility property to serve the public in these designated rural exchanges as providers of last resort. And the commission has held hearings and made determinations that all of these appellants cannot do that without facing financial need. And the commission has entered orders determining the monthly support amounts that each provider needs to receive to meet its financial need. So when the state of Texas compels us to use our property to serve the public and then revokes the very public support that they've already found we need to do that, that is a taking of private property without payment of just compensation, and it can be remedied by a damages judgment. The Heinrich decision makes clear that a takings claim is not barred by sovereign immunity, even though it requires payment of money. Now, the state argues that we don't have a valid takings claim because we could have pursued rate cases, in effect, to make up the missing TUSF payments by raising the prices or the rates that we charge our customers in all of these rural areas. Let me give two responses. First, the commission has already had rate proceedings where the commission has determined which rates or prices are reasonable for Texans in rural areas to pay to make their prices reasonably comparable to prices paid in urban areas. Okay, if you look at how much TUSF support we're getting in these exchanges, in some exchanges we're getting $200, $500, $800 per line. Okay, they're saying we should raise our prices to make up for that lost TUSF revenue when the commission has already found the reasonable rates for Windstream and CenturyLink to charge our customers are $23, $24 per month. There's just no way that the rate case would allow us to make up the lost TUSF revenue, and our customers wouldn't be able to pay $800 a month for landline service. So the rate cases are not an excuse for the takings violation. He also says the June 12 decision was mere inaction, and so it can't support a takings claim. But Chairman Walker said at the June 12 hearing that she had made the choice, not to provide full funding to the TUSF, but instead to implement this triage policy where the commission rations limited TUSF funds and prioritizes providers. Okay, that was an affirmative choice. If you read that transcript, the other two commissioners orally agreed with her on both of those points. That's an affirmative choice. They cannot insulate their decisions from judicial review by mislabeling their affirmative decisions as mere failures to act. The commission says it would need to raise the TUSF assessment rate to some astronomically high level to provide full funding to the TUSF, but simple math shows that isn't true. The increase on a phone bill would be about 75 cents a month if they had adopted their staff's proposed order back in June of 2020. And let me put this in context. Over time, the TUSF assessment rate has fluctuated. It's gone up and down. It's been as high as 5.65%. So when commission staff said, here, we can solve this problem right now by raising the assessment to 6.4%, they were not proposing some astronomically high increase. It's not that much higher than the 5.65% rate we've seen in the past. And the federal USF rate hovers at around 30%. So this is not a big ask. The commission also, if they don't want to raise the rate, they have other tools available. As you pointed out, they can apply the whatever rate they want to a broader set of services. they could also switch from a revenue-based assessment to a connections-based assessment. They have lots of discretion and lots of tools at their disposal to determine how to fund the TUSF, but they have no discretion to decide not to fund the TUSF, which is what they've done here.
If they change their method of funding, do you think they would have to have hearings to bring in all comers to talk about, well, now we're going to broaden the assessment pool?
It would require a new rulemaking. Yes, so they would have to do that, but that's their obligation as public officials to do things the right way. They can't just stop paying us. If there's a procedure that they want to go through to change the way they do this, they need to go through the procedure. They can't just stop paying us. The statute requires them to fund the TUSF. 56023, 1, 4, and 5 all require the commission to fund the TUSF. They don't say how much, but they say you have to fund the TUSF. The commission then has interpreted and implemented that statutory mandate in its rules. 26420E is where the commission defines the amount needed to fund the TUSF as including the costs of all these TUSF programs. Those costs, in turn, are spelled out in the 46 orders that are in the record. So if you take the statute together with the rules, together with the orders, you see the commission has a legal obligation to fund the TUSF at the level needed to pay the amount stated in these support orders. They haven't done that, and that's an ultra vires act. They have exceeded the legal limitations on their discretion.
So going back to one of the chief's first questions, in your view, then, the ultra vires act is the failure to fund and not the failure to pay, or both?
There's three ultra vires act. The contract amendment is an invalid rule and an ultra vires act. It should be declared invalid and enjoined. Failure to fund the TUSF, you asked about payment versus funding. One ultra vires act is the failure to fund the TUSF. Okay, they are statutorily obligated to ensure that the fund has the money in it to pay their obligations. And practically speaking, if they fund the TUSF, that probably takes care of everything because they have the money to pay us. We are also, though, asking an injunction and asserting an ultra vires claim against their failure to pay us, because payment of monies owed is a ministerial duty. Okay, an ultra.
And so now, one thing that would result in is between June and now, they've been month after month after month, people around Texas have received their phone bills and they didn't have the assessment. So how do you now claw back when you've given up those assessments and, you know, phone users in Dallas weren't charged, so the money didn't get deposited? How do you see that playing out if we now say we need to fully fund, so the assessment now has to be even more, 12, 15, 18% in order to claw back the months that they missed in the billing cycles?
So the commission, again, has broad discretion in deciding how to fund, so we wouldn't ask the court to order the commission to set some rate or to do it some way. That is their prerogative to figure out. They could switch to a connection-based system. They may have to raise the rate a little bit, apply it to broader services, but that is for them to decide how to fund the TUSF. They can't just decide not to fund the TUSF and not fund it for so long that they just never have to comply with their legal obligations. The law doesn't allow them to do that. There are so many claims and jurisdictional defenses the commission has. We prepared two exhibits, oral argument exhibits. One that goes through the claims we're asserting and shows the relief we're requesting. The other shows why
I gave Mr. Enoch kudos for that. Thank you.
He did a very good job on it. The other one shows why each one of those claims is not barred by sovereign immunity or the exhaustion of remedies doctrine. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, counsels, all of you. Thank you very much. This case will be submitted, and the court will stand in recess. Thank you for the well-prepared arguments, counsels. We appreciate it. Court will stand in recess.